single atom optical clocks and their relationship to possible variations of fundamental constants. Right from the beginning, I'd like to acknowledge my co-workers on the optical mercury clock. Wendell Oskey and Anders Busch have been key, as well as Luca Larini. On the aluminum clock, it's basically headed by Till Rosenband, with good help from David Hume and Pete Schmidt. We couldn't do any of the work that we've done without the femtosecond comb, both by Leo Holberg's group, Scott Diddams, Jason Stallnaker, and Tara Fortier, with the Thai sapphire comb. And in another room is a fiber comb, and the group is headed by Nate Newberry. So just a brief outline. I would like to talk a little bit about optical clocks, although that's been pretty well covered. I will go to immediately the mercury and aluminum clock transition spectroscopy, how we do that, the measurement of the aluminum to mercury ratio, and the systematic uncertainties, which are key. Maybe if there's time, a little bit about the free ion gymnastics and future plans. So we've already had a little bit of an introduction to what is a clock. Basically, there are two ingredients. One is that you have a periodic event generator. It doesn't need to be periodic, but most often it is. And then if you do have a periodic event generator, it can, if you can count the zero crossings or the events and accumulate and display them, then you have a clock. And that's the entry point. But if you want a standard or a anchored optical or standard clock, then you need an anchor. And for the optical clock, the anchor is often an atomic transition, neither an ion or a, a neutral atom. And with this anchor, you control with a feedback loop the frequency of the oscillator so that it's stabilized and accurate. And with the femtosecond comb then, which I won't discuss, you can divide down and count and display the events. So the clock frequency is equal to the energy of the separation of the anchor, again, an atom or an ion. And we're going to talk about clock shifts in the sense that anything that changes this energy difference, E2 minus E1, will be a systematic. And we want to keep that well in mind and well controlled. So this is what it's about. We have some oscillator. In this case, I'm showing the frequency generated by a microwave oscillator at 10 to the 10 hertz, something akin to the cesium atom. The time is the phase of the sinusoid, and the measurement error is sigma y, which is how well you can look and see a zero crossing, how much noise there is. And then in turn gives a error in time that's equal to sigma y, the measurement error in determining the zero crossing, divided by the frequency. So for microwave standards like NIST F1, where there are on the order of 10,000 atoms in a pitch of in the microwave fountain experiment, they cool a cloud of atoms and then they pitch it in the air as if pitching a ball, and it goes through a microwave zone and comes back through. The 10,000 balls gives a measurement uncertainty of square root of 10,000, which is about 1%. And then in comparison, the optical with a single atom is a at quite a higher frequency, 10 to the 15 cycles per second. But the measurement error for a zero crossing is on the order of 1. So we trade basically voices in the choir for accuracy. And we'll get to what I mean by that in a minute. So for the optical clocks, the frequency is 100,000 times larger. It's on the order of 10 to the 15 cycles per second for the UV optical clocks that I'll discuss. And since the uncertainty is on the order of 1, the optical time error for a single measurement is 100 to 1,000 times smaller. even for a single atom. So what are the two systems? The first system is a mercury ion standard. And I won't go into great detail about what the trap looks like. It's basically a spherical Powell trap, two end caps sandwiching a ring electrode. That trap is placed in a pillbox, which is at the bottom of a cryogenic helium door. And there are optics inside that can work at room temperature equally as well at liquid helium temperature, ovens to boil off a little bit of mercury from mercury oxide source, and an electron gun to make a single mercury atom at the bottom of this door. Likewise, we have long-lived systems. Once we load the mercury ion, we don't lose it until we do something stupid. So we've been able to hold a single ion for half a year, not a year, but for a half a year. The quantum jump spectroscopy for mercury is going to be shown here. We have a cooling transition from doublet S1/2 to doublet P1/2, it's alkaline-like, at 194 nanometers. It lives for about 2 nanoseconds, so once the atom is cold, it will scatter on the order of 100 million photons per second. So in gathering a few of those, you have quite a signal to noise. The clock transition is at 282 nanometers at 10 to the 15 cycles per second, roughly, or almost exactly, from a doublet S1/2 to a doublet D5/2 state. And we do now quench the doublet D5/2 state once the clock transition has been made. So the sequence goes that you have, in the absence of the 194 nanometer radiation, so there's not any perturbation due to that, you drive the clock transition. And with some probability, you make the transition from doublet S1/2 to doublet D5/2. And you ask the question, has the transition occurred? If not, the electron remains in the ground state. You turn on the 194 nanometer radiation detection pulse, and the ion can make several transitions, driven up and spontaneously decaying, giving off a flux of photons, some of which are captured and counted. And in the event that the answer is yes, you've made the clock transition, the electron is parked in the metastable state. Now if you apply the 194 nanometer detection pulse, no transitions are made and zero photons are recorded. So with nearly unit probability, you can see each and every transition in a single atom. And if you're going to work with a single atom, you want to be in that case. So if we set the detection threshold, say here, basically, in spite of the noise on the 194 nanometer radiation, we will be able to see each and every transition made. So we're projection noise limited. What about aluminum? Aluminum is a slightly different animal. The clock transition is from single S0 to triple T0. It's an intercombination line that's weakly allowed. The cooling radiation, if we could use it, would be from the doublet S0 to a singlet S0 to a singlet P1 at 167 nanometers. And that's just a little bit tough to make. So basically, practically, this atom has no cooling transition, no detection transition, no state preparation transition. All it has is a clock transition. There are two of them, sort of. One from the singlet S0 to triplet P1, which I'm going to call fast enough, and you'll see what I mean by that in a moment. And the other from the singlet S0 to triplet P0, which is going to be our clock transition. And that's slow enough with a lifetime of 21 seconds. So we're going to do the spectroscopy of aluminum. And again, we're going to have a very narrow transition and so on. It's going to be immune from perturbations from external fields, and it has a small black body shift, but it does not have the cooling detection and state preparation transition at 167 nanometers. So at this point, basically at the Scottish conference in 2001, Dave Wineland made the proposal that we could use quantum logic techniques, quantum information processing, to work with any atom that you wanted to pick, or any ion that you wanted to pick as a clock ion, and make a clock out of it. And when he made the proposal, I thought pie in the sky, it may work, but it wouldn't be practical. But in a short order, Pete Schmidt and Phil Rosenband not only made it work, but made it work extremely well. So the logic ion that's going to be part of the system is beryllium, plus the trap is going to be now a linear trap, not a spherical trap. The beryllium will be trapped simultaneously with the aluminum, and the beryllium will be used to do the laser cooling, state preparation, and state detection. So for that to work, you have to understand that these ions are coupled through their Coulomb interaction, and so that produces normal modes of oscillation, secular frequency. The center of mass mode that is typical is at 2.62 megahertz, where the aluminum and the beryllium move together. You have the stretch mode, which is higher, at typically 5.8 megahertz. And these are along the axis, but you also have the perpendicular motions, both in the x and the y direction. And you have one where the aluminum ion surprisingly does most of the amplitude of motion, and the beryllium hardly moves. And that's at 3.5 megahertz. But you also have the case where the aluminum basically sits still and the beryllium ion moves, and it moves at a much higher frequency, 13 megahertz. These are pernicious because once you do the cooling, it's very difficult to cool the aluminum motion in this case by cooling on the beryllium because they're only weakly coupled along the radial direction, basically by the axis that joins them. But the center mass motion and the stretch motion can be cooled and cooled very well. So when you do that and look at the red sideband and the stretch and the center mass motion, center mass here, stretch here, they basically are gone when you have cooled to n equals zero, while the upper sidebands remain because you can still make a transition to the ground state on the vibrational ladder. Okay, so what about the clock state transfer to beryllium plus, and how is this going to work? And a simplified version of this is that we're going to use the beryllium to cool the motional quantum ground state. And then, depending on the clock state that we've created in aluminum, we'll either add vibrational energy or not to the two coupled atoms. And then we'll detect that vibrational energy via the beryllium plus. And then we'll repeat. So this was the first in many papers that have been generated for quantum computing and quantum information processing many years ago by Dan Heinsohn and Dave Wineland, where a single trapped ion in this case was argued could be laser cooled into its quantum ground state of motion and used as a very low temperature detector of radio frequency signals applied to the trap end caps. So here's how it's going to work. Here is now again the aluminum system. The transitions that I'm going to be talking about now are not associated with the singlet S0, singlet S1, but singlet S0 to triplet P1 and singlet S0 to triplet P0. This is going to be the clock transition. This will be our heating transition. They're both roughly at 267 nanometers, even though they're shown to be slightly different. They're dressed by the vibrational motion. We're cooling to the ground state, so we are only going to put one quantum of energy into the vibrational motion when we have made the transition, when we haven't made the transition to the triple P0 state. So to see that, we'll again drive the clock transition in the absence of radiation, or actually in the presence of radiation on the beryllium atom, it's fine. And so then they ask, is transition occurred? No, then we remain in the singlet S0 state, and N equal to zero for the secular motion. We turn on a blue sideband then that will drive from N equals zero, singlet S0, N equals zero, to triplet P1, N equal one, putting a quantum of vibrational energy into the system. And then we're left with a triplet P1 state and one vibrational motion of energy. If the answer is yes, that we've made the clock transition, now we're in the triplet P0 state with N equal to zero, not the singlet S0, N equals zero. We apply the blue sideband and we remain in the triplet P0, N equals zero state. If again, now we go back and look at the answer no, will spontaneously decay in a short amount of time, 300 microseconds, remember, for the triplet P1 state lifetime. And that puts us back into the singlet S0 state with a quantum of energy. And again, if the answer is yes, we're in the singlet S0 state with no quantum of energy. So now that resides in both atoms, that quantum of energy, and we're going to look in the single phonon detection with the beryllium atom. So we start with either the atom having been driven into the singlet X, or sorry, the triple P0 state with no quantum. The beryllium atom will start with N equals zero and we'll put on a red sideband in both cases. And driving, if we do have a quantum of energy, we can go from N equals one to N equals zero in the excited state. Remember that that's allowed. And then we'll prepare doublet S1/2, F equal one, N equal one. Or if we have remained in the, sorry, if we've gone to the clock excited state, I'm sorry, I'm mixing these two columns up, then we'll have doublet S1/2, F equal two, N equals zero. And then we'll do our detection pulse as we did on mercury, on beryllium. And if we remain in the N equals zero state, we'll see fluorescence and spontaneous decay. I mean, drive the transition, see spontaneous decay and fluorescence and gather a bit of that. Typically on the order of 8 photons per couple hundred microseconds. And we can repeat that experiment. It's a quantum non-demolition experiment until we get good statistics, because if it's in the triplet P0 state, it will stay there while we cycle again and again and again on the triplet P1. And so in doing so, we get a fidelity, a detection fidelity of nearly 100%. So if we drive the transition with 100 millisecond pulse time in 50 scans, this is a typical signal. You can see the contrast is nearly one, and the line width is Fourier transform time limited to the 100 millisecond pulse time, giving 8.4 hertz for the line width. Now, if I have a little bit of time, I'm going to do this a little bit differently. So here we go with a pictorial demonstration of that scheme. We have a clock ion that is going to be used for the variactor measurement. This is Till Rosenband. He'll represent our clock atom. And then we'll need the logic ion. This is Dave Wineland, the author of the technique, for cooling and readout. And they'll be coupled by their Coulomb repulsion for each other. And so they're loaded into the trap and they have a lot of energy, and you cool on the logic ion. And by the Coulomb coupling, it brings the clock ion to rest. And now the ion motion is quantized. Either N equals zero, they're at rest, or you can put a quantum of energy in and they oscillate back and forth. And now we're going to transfer the information from the aluminum ion, remember that we impressed upon it with a clock pulse, to the motional couple, or an emotional state between the two atoms, and then read out with the beryllium. So clock pulse applied to the clock ion. That information is passed through the secular motion to the logic ion faithfully, and the logic ion then reads it out. So to see how this works again, clock, answer no. We're still in the N equals zero to secular motion ground state, as well as the electronic ground state, apply a blue psi band pulse, put a quantum of energy into the system, both ions are moving. If a clock transition has been made, then the clock ion is excited, and we apply a blue psi band and remain in the singlet S0 ground state. Now the readout has been done with either yes or no, that there is a quantum of energy in the vibrational motion coupling the two ions. Then if that's the case, you excite the logic ion, scatters photons which are detected, and read out again either about one if the answer, if the transition has been made in 200 microseconds, or 4 to 10, typically about 8 in 200 microseconds if the transition has not been made. Or, yes. So now that we have the two clocks, and I'll make a comment or two about the systematics in just a bit. We need to compare the two, and again, we use a frequency comb to do so. Here is a schematic representation then of what goes on. In our mercury case, we have a stable cavity hung in a vacuum system with produces spectrally pure radiation at 563 nanometers, which is doubled to 282 nanometers, which probes the mercury ion. That starts from a fiber laser at 1126 nanometers, which is sent by a fiber with Doppler cancellation to one of the femtosecond combs, or to both of them actually. And in both cases, the comb is locked to the mercury system. And then simultaneously with a fiber laser again at 1070 nanometers, which is doubled to the green and locked to its cavity, and doubled to 267 nanometers to probe the aluminum ion and lock up. That light is sent up in the infrared to the same comb, and the V frequency is red. And that way we can compare the two. The comparison gives a metric insensitive ratio of this number, which is basically 1.05, to 17 digits over the last basically year of operation. So the last run that we made was in December of last year. We're gearing up to do another measurement which will have significantly better statistics. So at this point, I'll point out the division here is 10 to the minus 16. So this is at the level of measuring at the 17th digit. The stability that we achieved with the two systems is shown here. Projected back to 1 second, it's roughly 4 times 10 to the minus 15 tau to the minus 1/2. And begins to show you why, even if the microwave clocks and the optical clocks end up with the same accuracy, why you would want to work with an optical clock. And that is that you get to parts in 10 to the 16, parts in 10 to the 17 in reasonable time. Whereas with a microwave clock, you would have to go for days, if not months. Every factor of 2 that you get here gives you a factor of 4 less shorter measuring time to get to the same precision. So here I've done a preliminary, not a preliminary, error budget for mercury with a shift that is associated with the different effects Black body shift, flank of motion, second order Doppler, flank of motion, AC start, so and so on. And the biggest shift that we have is due to the weak magnetic field that we apply of about 80 milligauss, which shifts the transition by about a hertz. But that's known in the uncertainty is on the order of a half of, sorry, 0.5 times 10 to the minus 17. And in the future experiment, this will be held to less than a part in 10 to the 18. The biggest problem that we have is the micromotion eight, no, sorry. I'm looking for it. It's associated with a micromotion Zeeman, second order Zeeman due to the, here it is, AC Zeeman from the trap RMS field. We've not done an actual measurement of it. We've done an estimate of it, and the uncertainty we estimate to be on the order of about a part in 10 to the 17. We're going to measure this by looking at the hyperfine transition in mercury, which will have about the same shift, but at five orders of magnitude lower frequency. So it'll be easy to read this out. And in the next version of this, then we expect to be at about 3 times 10 to the minus 18. Just needed to hit the button one more time. The aluminum error budget is shown here. The biggest uncertainties come from basically second order Doppler effects associated with the radial temperature that I pointed out at the beginning. It's difficult with beryllium to cool the aluminum very well, although it's done pretty well in a tricky maneuver that allows the uncertainty to be on the order of a part in 10 to the minus 17. With the new trap and the new system, instead of beryllium, magnesium will be the logic ion, which basically is the same charge to mass ratio as aluminum and will be much better at cooling the secular motion in the radial direction. This is the one that stopped us about a year ago from publishing, and it was something that Dave Wineland pointed out that we had to worry about, it was first order Doppler chirping. And to see how that works, imagine again in the aluminum case that the ion is trapped at the center of the trap. You turn on the light field or turn off the light field, either way, you're alternately turning on radiation fields that are beams going through the trap. The laser lights has to generate photoelectrons on the surface of the trap electrodes. And let's say, for example, they create three photoelectrons that are separated from the rods, basically, so that they're bare electrons. They pull on the clock ion, and three are enough to pull at enough shift that it corresponds to about 3 times 10 to the minus 17 second order. And so this was an enormous effect. Of course, the electrons are normally shielded, and it may not be that big at all. But it gives you a feeling for some of the things that you have to worry about. After the probes, say, pulse, the electrons discharge, they go away, and the aluminum ion goes back. And so it goes back and forth consistently with every time you probe. So the only way to solve that problem is instead of arguing it away or arguing that it has to be small, is to put on a second beam at the back, which is alternatively tuned into resonance, and this one out of resonance, or this one into resonance, and this one out of resonance each time. And so the field or the photon flux on the rods is the same each time, and the shift, once you probe in both directions, average together gives an average of that zero shift. The effect was not noticeable in the aluminum measurements. Similarly, in the mercury measurements, and it took us a longer time to set that up. And here is the official results for the runs from December of 2006 to December of 2007. And it corresponds to a restriction that says that alpha dot alpha is consistent with zero at the level of -1.6 plus or -2.4 times 10 to minus 17 per year. And as Eckhart has pointed out, just by comparing the aluminum and mercury, which are electronic transitions and have a weak dependence on any of the other fundamental constants, this is basically a test for the alpha. So this is basically a column, a very narrow column that was achieved in about a year's time of measurements. That combined with the mercury measurements against cesium, which then are cesium dependent, that intersection then, as opposed to what had existed in the uncertainty sphere for, say, in this case, the magnetic moment of cesium over the Bohr magneton drift versus alpha dot, has been more tightly restricted. Let's just put it that way. And if you look closely, this is the level that we've come to, again, with the mercury versus cesium over a period of about 7 years. And this is mercury versus aluminum over the period of about a year. We will be hard pressed to make this much tighter, whereas this column should decrease by another almost order of magnitude with our next run, when we hope to be at a few parts in 10 to the 18. So I'm going to finish with what is now the new system for aluminum. So again, it existed in this fashion with a fiber laser, a doubler, a cavity, another doubler probing an aluminum. The logic ion was beryllium, requiring several dye lasers to work with that system. It's remarkable, but they all work extremely well. And the clock laser was a dye laser at the beginning of the experiments. This has been replaced, as I pointed out, by a fiber laser that's doubled twice to probe the aluminum ion. Now we are replacing beryllium with magnesium. It requires really only a fiber laser and AOMs, but it's a little more convenient with two fiber lasers. Those are now in hand. The trap is in hand. The magnesium has been shown to work, so hopefully the system will be up by the end of the summer. And we have played with putting in three ions, two clock ions. So the outlook for the future is keep measuring aluminum mercury ratio, and again, it's metric independent. Compare aluminum with other standards, and I have next week. Well, we hope that our system is back together. We've made major changes to the mercury system, and so it's not clear whether we will be ready to run by next week. Continue to look for variations of fundamental constants, and as I pointed out, these things are happening. And with that, I think I'll conclude. Thank you for your attention.
First order Doppler effect by shining light from different directions, doesn't this rely on some very high symmetry? So the number of those electrons that we get when you shine light is...
The number of electrons is... It doesn't require that to be symmetric, so the ion can still move always in one direction. It requires that both beams come on each time. So let's say that one beam knocks off more electrons and it runs in one direction with each probe. It'll Doppler shift in one direction for one of the probes, but Doppler shift in the opposite direction for the other probe. So if you alternate which probe is doing by adjusting the frequency slightly, which is doing the clock pulse, then you can average that effect away. And in fact, you can look specifically if there is any effect by looking for many times on one side and many times on the other side. And we've done that as well, and I've seen no effect.
Yeah. Jim, you're measuring, doing a relative measurement, aluminum versus mercury, because you cannot compare at that level of accuracy to the absolute standard. So, but if you would measure an absolute frequency in this system, what would be the gravitational effect as for each meter on the clock precision?
For each meter, it's 10 in minus 16.
10 minus 16?
Yeah, so
per meter.
At the next step, we have to be a little more careful about the height difference between the three systems.
Yeah.
Well, when I say that, we've measured it very carefully between aluminum and mercury, and we'll never be able to do the microwave to a level that we need to measure the height any better than 10 centimeters.
Mm-hmm. Any other
questions? But it is interesting. We are going to compare against, and have compared against Junyi and his strontium clock and Shilla, as well as upstairs they have ytterbium clock and calcium clock. And there we do have to be careful about the height difference. And across Boulder, more than the height, it's what's underneath us and next to us, as opposed to the plains of Kansas or flatter areas. And so the uncertainty from the geoids or in the geoid is at least 30 centimeters. So we have to take care about that.
So
we can turn it around and measure the geoid gravitational potential, mm-hmm. if you believe that we're doing things correctly.
I think the viral protein is a topic that really hit in Tampa, because that he found that in the end of his career, he arrived to creating alchemy. Instead of thoughts.
Any other questions? May I ask a question, please? You told about uncertainty in second order Doppler shift because of incomplete cooling. But your atom is in a definite vibrational state. Does it mean that there is no uncertainty at all? Because it's just average second order Doppler over specific wave functions. It's a number, it's not uncertainty.
If that were true for both systems, that's correct. But again, remember that in the aluminum system, the cooling to n equals zero is done principally on a stretch of the center mass motion, so that the coupling can be cured of whatever superposition state you have on the clock ion to the superposition state of the beryllium ion through the secondary motion. But the radial direction is not so well held, and so its average secular number is not zero or one, but about 0.4.
So it's not an indefinite vibrational state, right?
Right.
So there is still some uncertainty in vibrations.
Yeah, and that will have to be done better. And will be done better in the next system with magnesium.
And next question, your application, this limit on alpha is called a preliminary. Is it still
which
in your publication in Science, the limit is called preliminary.
It's not.
Is it preliminary or it's a final word?
It's final.
So it's not preliminary anymore.
Okay. No,
no. So any other questions? So if not, we have a coffee break, but again, I would like to ask you to do a favor. To finish your coffee here 3 minutes before the beginning. So you will